dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This weekend, more than 3,000 media activists gathered in Minneapolis for the National Conference on Media Reform, organized by Free Press, an organization devoted to dismantling the corporate-controlled propaganda machine that now passes for media in the USA. That the U.S. is a lot worse as a country than it ought to be, I lay at the door of the corporate media, which misinforms, disinforms, and fails to inform those who partake of it. If most people heard or saw a media that discussed widely the material you hear on this show, I have no doubt whatever that the consumerist stupefaction of the nation would end. The stupefaction is deliberate, as are the lies. It makes me crazy every time I hear some talking head or pundit or politician pretend they didn't know from Jump Street that, for example, the Bush administration lied about WMD in Iraq. You and I knew it was a lie. And if I, a radio producer with a budget of zero and a staff of one, who lives in a rural town with a population slightly above 2,000, can find that out and report on it, you bet those well-funded networks can. The people who run them may be craven and they may be cowards, but they're not stupid. They lie to us because they want us to be ignorant and subservient. Knowledge is power, and that's why a free press matters. This week, I'm going to bring you a selection of speakers from the large and diverse conference. I know that Democracy Now! Also intends to cover the conference on the show this coming week, so I apologize in advance in the event of duplication, as I know most of you are Democracy Now! Listeners as well. We'll begin with Josh Silver, Executive Director of Free Press.
I cannot tell you people how exciting it is to look out at all your faces, know that about twice as many people will be here throughout the day, trickling in to over 3,000 people, and know that this conference and this movement for media reform is growing to a level that we never, ever could have imagined 5 years ago. We are, as we look around, it occurs to me that we really are more than a national conference for media reform. This is truly becoming a national movement for media reform. And it is all about you. You know, I never thought I would open this conference with a quote from Scott McClellan. It's a little weird. The man who spoke for the Bush White House during the war in Iraq admits that, quote, the National Press Corps was probably too deferential to the White House and to the administration in regard to the most important decision facing our nation, the choice over whether to go to war in Iraq. That's putting it mildly. Later, McClellan said that the news media were, quote, complicit enablers in the White House's carefully orchestrated campaign to shape and manipulate sources of public approval. More and more reporters, including major correspondents like Jessica Yellen and Chris Matthews, have recently admitted that their bosses were pro-war and it slanted their coverage. These Johnny-come-lately confessions confirm what's been obvious to almost everyone in this room for years. The corporate media is not a watchdog protecting us from the powerful. It is a lapdog begging for scraps. But for us here today, being right is no consolation in the face of damage done by the media's love affair with the White House. Government and corporate propaganda have laid waste to journalistic integrity. We know now that the Pentagon poured millions of dollars into a covert campaign to sell the Iraq War to the American people who sacrificed their blood and the goodwill of other nations. And the media handed over the megaphone, allowing the Pentagon to invade our airwaves, and newspaper stands with an army of retired generals. These so-called message force multipliers appeared or were cited more than 4,500 times on all the major television networks and even NPR. We now know that the media rolled over for the Bush administration, not just about the war in Iraq, but about nearly every major decision facing our nation. From message multipliers to prepackaged and undisclosed propaganda on our local nightly news, to pundits for hire like Armstrong Williams, we now know that our leaders preyed on our fears with a cynical PR campaign that raised homeland security warnings to Orwellian orange and red to distract from the administration's latest embarrassing or illegal acts. We now know that the corporate media, the source of news for more than 90% of Americans, acted as their willing mouthpiece. For far too long, the American people have been made afraid. We have been left in the dark, not just by our government, but by the media that was supposed to keep us informed. 88 years ago, journalist Walter Lippmann said, "All that the sharpest critics of democracy have alleged is true. If there is no steady supply of trustworthy and relevant news, incompetence and aimlessness, corruption and disloyalty, panic and ultimate disaster must come to any people which is denied and assured access to the facts. Without those facts, we followed the flag into a disastrous war in Iraq. Without those facts, our economy crumbles and 37 million Americans live in poverty. Without the facts, our nation's infrastructure is in tatters, and victims of Hurricane Katrina are left behind. Without the facts, our climate crisis may have moved beyond repair. Without the facts, without a critical, accountable, fearless media system, we've arrived at one of the darkest moments in our nation's history. But the media problem isn't really about the journalists. It's not really about the TV show producers, and it's not even about Scott McClellan. Although many of them are complicit, this is about the people at the top. This is about big media owners who decided it's in their best interests to join hands with the Bush administration and global corporations at the expense of all Americans and democracy itself. Our consolidated broken media system gives moguls like Rupert Murdoch the omnipotent power to decide what's news and what isn't, which lives are important and which aren't, which myth the American people will see and which reality they won't. Friends, we are living in a matrix, and big media is writing the script. For these owners, it's good business to deliver bad media. It's important you understand that. Big media dollars, the advertisers do not want gruesome images from Iraq to follow ads for Happy Meals and Humvees. Hard-hitting journalism is expensive and jeopardizes big media's closed-door relationship with politicians. So we must ask ourselves, what kind of country has a media system that helps our leaders trick the American people into an unnecessary war? We have to ask ourselves, what kind of country has a media system more concerned about Paris Hilton than genocide in Africa? What kind of country has a media system that covers elections by scandal-mongering, ignoring any pretense of exploring real issues? What has happened to our democracy? I'll tell you exactly what happened. Big media forced it off the road, into a ditch, let it burn, and cried alligator tears all the way to the bank. And our corrupt, money-driven political system let it happen. When you have an entire media industrial complex against you, it's easy to feel defeated. Sometimes it takes a transformative moment to realize that you can actually do something about it. I had that moment 13 years ago, traveling in the Peruvian rainforest. I was with my friend Patchen Miller. At 26 years old, we were longtime travel companions. By the time we decided to float the headwaters of the Amazon, Patchen had already spent most of his short life doing community service. I had dabbled in public service, but had yet to figure out my own path. On the third night, we were ambushed. Patchen was shot and killed at close range. I was shot in the leg, and I narrowly escaped. It took a week to make it back to Lima, where they removed 7 pieces of lead from my leg. At the hospital, the surgeon kept shaking his head, looking at how close the lead had come to the artery. He said, "Tiene mucha suerte, hombre. Mucho suerte. You're very lucky, young man. Very, very lucky." I came back from that trip a changed person. At the age of 26, I was suddenly aware of my own mortality. It was several years before most people realized that their life on this earth is short. And I knew in my bones that this short life that luck or fate had granted me would be committed to making the world a better place. And from that day forward, I also felt that I was living my life both for Patchen and for me, that my experiences and my successes were both of ours. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have to go off to the Peruvian rainforest and get shot to do good social change. But I am suggesting that every one of us has the potential to be a powerful agent for change. You, me, the person sitting next to you. There are extraordinary people in this room and coming later in the day and tomorrow. Look around. There are people who have fought this fight for years. There's people who are new to these issues of media reform and ready to get to work. There are people with talent and passion and the will to win a better life for this country. People who have brought the media reform movement to a level previously unimagined. Who could imagine the victories we've had since this conference last met in Memphis? Just last month, together, we got the United States Senate to overwhelmingly reject the FCC's latest outrageous attempt to let big media get even bigger. Come on. Together, we stopped the White House and Congress from abolishing net neutrality and turning the internet into a private fiefdom for the cable and phone companies. Together, we're pushing Congress to award thousands of new low-power FM radio licenses to cities and towns that desperately need independent voices. Together, we're challenging unfair postal rate hikes that threaten to shut down independent publications that are the lifeblood of our democracy. And together, we have created a movement made of thousands of people who are committed to creating a media system we need. And for the first time ever, we have presidential candidates who are discussing and debating open internet and media consolidation. But right now, we are at a crossroads. Right now, we stand on the brink of the greatest opportunity in generations to break the corporate media's stranglehold on democracy. In a few years, nearly all of our media, television, radio, newspapers, phone service, movies, will all be delivered through a high-speed internet connection. At this critical junction, we cannot ignore history. We must learn from it. In the past, every time a new technology emerged with the power to give a voice to the voiceless, there was a great moment of hope. We saw it when radio was invented in the 1920s, television in the 1950s, cable television in the 1980s. Each time media moguls send their hired guns to Washington to co-opt and monetize these technologies before they even get off the ground. Each time the best and greatest chance for everyday people to reclaim the media was sacrificed to corporate power. Each time the public had no idea laws were being passed in their name that were killing the dream. The ruinous state of the media we see today, as Bob McChesney always says, is the result of those disastrous policies. But this time is different. This time we stand at a moment of opportunity with the internet. This time we have a tool that not only speaks truth to power, it can organize truth against power. This time we can use the internet to save the internet. And we know that the future will go down one of two paths. The first is the righteous path. It's of openness, a new media world that treats all content equally. No slow lanes for us and fast lanes for them. An internet where anyone with a good idea can make it big and make a difference. An internet that is fast, affordable, and accessible to everyone, rich and poor, urban and rural. The second path is a closed internet. An internet that looks like radio, TV, or cable. An internet where giant phone and cable companies decide what's on, how much it costs, and how fast it downloads. Internet that is no longer a vibrant town square for all of us, but a cash cow for a few. Where free speech is censored and status quo is king. In this high-stakes debate over the future of the internet, the future of virtually all media, it's either open or closed. It's all or nothing. It is a clash between democracy and plutocracy that will be fought on every street corner from here to Pennsylvania Avenue to Main Street. It's going to be fought everywhere, and it's one of the most profound fights of our lives. As Van Jones said at the last conference, he said, "You don't believe me, but it's true." On the eve of his 1936 re-election, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the architect of the New Deal, spoke words as true today as they were 72 years ago. He said, quote, "We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. We know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob." FDR passed the New Deal because he took the fight to his opposition, and he never backed down, and neither will we. Because we dedicate ourselves here today to the proposition that our fight for a democratic, open internet and independent media will end the historic pattern of monopoly that suffocates freedom, dissent, and creativity. Because the future of the media does not belong to Rupert Murdoch. The future of the media does not belong to Comcast and AT&T. The future of our media does not belong to Clear Channel, Verizon, and Tribune Company. The future of the media belongs to us. All of us. And everyone watching across this country. We are here in Minneapolis today and this weekend to fight for that all the media that we want. And mark my words, we will not stop this fight until we win. Thank you and welcome to Minneapolis.
Josh Silver, Executive Director of Free Press, opening the National Conference on Media Reform.
Our next speaker is equally amazing. She's a writer, a singer, and an activist. She's co-founder of the League of Young Voters, and currently she's the executive director of the Ruckus Society. Yep. She believes that actions speak louder than words, and she lives that way. Adrienne Marie Brown.
Good morning. So, someone left their water up here. That's not good for the visuals. I'll take it down. So I'm going to sing a little wake-up song for y'all real quick. How you feel about that? Good? Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia. All right. So, I wanted to start with that because I'm kind of an unlikely candidate to be speaking at this conference, because I wake up every morning with my mind set on freedom, and a lot of times I don't wake up with my mind set on reform. But I do have a vision for how you all can be a part of this vision I have for freedom, and I'm here to entice you, hopefully, into that vision. So prepare for just blameless and shameless enticement. Fundamentally, a revolutionary mindset has the ability to see beyond what currently exists and beyond tweaking what currently exists to something altogether new. New relationships, new power dynamics, new media. Media which exists not only to inform us, but to transform us so that when we hear it, when we see it, we're not just taking in that information, but we actually change the way we behave, change the way we interact with the world. We want media that is available to everyone, not just as consumers, but as co-creators. Now, I work at an organization called the Ruckus Society, and much of what we do is training people in nonviolent direct action, but it's actually really about direct communication. And you may have seen us recently, some of our Ruckus Network folks up on the Golden Gate Bridge with the Students for a Free Tibet. We did a beautiful banner action out there. And is impacting international opinion and international responses to the Tibetan people. And that's an impact led by the Tibetan people. That's the kind of work that we do. We work with communities that have very few monetary resources, don't control their airwaves, and we help them to communicate directly between themselves and among themselves, and then also turn that towards the decision makers. But that means for us not just communicating towards our opposition. Reaction for us is inherently framed by the opposition, so it's never the most powerful position. In this day and age, we want to be good at reaction, but we need to become a lot better at proaction and at vision. Thank you. So coming here this morning, I spoke to my community. I reached out to all the folks in the media justice world, and I said, what do I need to talk to this group about? And I got so many responses back. And, you know, this is the 5-year anniversary of the term media justice being founded being coined at the Highlander Center. Y'all know what the Highlander Center is? Okay. You should definitely go sit up on that hill and do some contemplating if you haven't done it. But some of my community came back to me and they said, okay, Adrian, you really need to talk about how we produce our media. We need to move from being passive consumers to active creators. We want to be the ones who are telling the stories of our lives. And that's fundamentally about who is producing that media. I speak with a technology expert all the time about, like, can we do this for Ruckus? Can we do this kind of crazy technology for our mobilization? And he always says to me, you can do anything you want, literally everything you could possibly imagine in terms of technology for communication and mobilizing exists. You just can't afford it. It's not accessible to you, right? And I feel like that's very much what we deal with the process of democratizing our media. And I'm involved with an organization called the Allied Media Conference, which is coming up. Ow! That's a good sound. So that's coming up in Detroit, June 20th through the 22nd, and it's primarily about taking these media skills that seem out of the realm of these young communities of color that we work with and bringing those skills back to the community. Some of the folks that I spoke with, and by the way, the skills we're talking about there is young people having their own low-power FM radio stations, being able to do video blogging, creating their own web zines and physical zines so that they're speaking about themselves, not just being observed as dropouts or, you know, kids in the street or something along those lines. And some of the folks I spoke to said that it's really about what we talk about. We have to begin putting our own stories front and center and focusing on the success and vision instead of just having a slightly better analysis around the mainstream drama, trauma, and scandal circuit. Moving from stories of individuals to stories of community, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Coalition of Immokalee Workers here. How many of y'all have been aware of the recent success that they had? Yes? Okay. So I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I'm going to say they're badass. They're completely badass. And the win that they just had is a media justice win. They were able to organize using their radio and their community to bring down Burger King, who had been spying on them and oppressing them. Okay? That's the kind of media that we want to see, that success story. And I love being clapped for. I just have a limited time, so that's the only reason I'm talking over the wonderful applause. This is also the kind of work we see when we see groups like Detroit Summer, who create an audio documentary about the dropout rate in Detroit and talk about their vision for community education, then took that project to Palestine, where they worked with young people in Palestine to talk about their dreams behind the wall and what their visions for their lives are and a nonviolent way of responding and growing in that space. So that kind of developing a racial analysis from the Middle East to the U.S., that's the kind of visioning and sort of cutting-edge information that we want to be communicating. Now, some of the folks said, Adrian, the only thing you should talk about is fighting for our right to any and all media of our choice. That struggle is fundamentally about understanding policy. The exciting thing right now is that that struggle is finally going local. There are statewide and regional networks developing through the Media Action Grassroots Network, which is housed at the Center for Media Justice. Y'all know that? Yay, Center for Media Justice, we love them. But they're bringing together all of these local hubs of media justice organizers to create a national network that's working on this issue. The reason that matters is because while a lot of people in this room are interested in following every aspect of media policy and fighting for it, most of the people out in the community doing the grassroots work, that's not what they're thinking about day in and day out. And so fundamentally weaving why access to the internet and access to media is important to them winning their struggles, that's the front line of this media reform work. That's where the work and the resources need to go. So I really want to highlight that work. I'm glad that I was told to talk about it. It's all magnet, all right? Okay, girl, you just, you know, jump in anytime. So one of the things that really occurred to me is that we really need to give up our fear of defining the trends for the mainstream. We're very comfortable over on the margins holding it down. But media, we need the kind of media that won't marginalize a stolen election. And as being a conspiracy theory of left-wing organizers, until a Kennedy writes about it in Vanity Fair 2 years later. It is up to us, particularly this year, to stop pretending that voter mobilization behind an exciting candidate and scandal-based media is going to be enough to actually change the direction of this country after years now of stolen elections. There's something you should all know, which is that there are some people out there who think the only thing worse than having a Democrat or a progressive in office is having a black man in office. And they're going to go all out this year. And it is up to us in this room to normalize a fair election and to really speak openly about what's going to happen to us this year. That's on y'all, right? So I give it to you. Take care of your business and really cover these stories. I also say that we need to be as comprehensive a movement as possible. So when all of my friends talk to me about it's this issue, it's that issue, to me it's all of those issues. We need to act like we love our media and that we recognize that media is the fundamental connective tissue that all communities are built on. It's the way we communicate with each other and it's the most important thing and we must protect it. But that means we must be respectful of each other. Over here in the media reform world, we need to have a deep respect for those in the community organizing world and vice versa. And that means that you can't just ask us to come to your media policy struggle. You need to come meet us where we're at and support us on the front lines of our organizing, right? But we're not starting from scratch. There's some amazing projects out there. Davey D is breaking down the barriers between entertainment and media with Breakdown FM. Agitpop is out there and SourceWatch is out there with all these amazing flash videos and wikis that are sharing credible information, and that gives us access and control over spaces like YouTube and Google, which a lot of times we're going to be like, ooh, YouTube and Google. But you know what? That's where we go beyond the choir and really reach our audiences. I already talked about the Coalition of Mockley Workers. They're amazing. Obviously, I have amazing notes here. As journalists, primarily I want to talk to you. There are some of you who already recognize this and some of you who don't, but ambivalence and complacency only serve injustice. It is your time right now to move out of the role of observer and into the role of a companion and an ally and a fighter in this struggle. We need media right now that supports those of us who are taking it to the streets and accurately identifies and tells the story and shows the story and inspires more people to join us in fighting against our discontent in this country and having a real vision. I invite you to join me as visionaries. I love you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful time here in Minneapolis.
Adrienne Marie Brown from the Ruckus Society. Our next speaker is Lawrence Lessig, professor at Stanford Law School and founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society.
So about 14 years ago, a professor of math at Lynchburg University discovered a flaw in the Pentium chip. Deep in the code of the SRT algorithm to calculate intermediate quotients necessary for iterative fixing of floating point divisions, it took me so long to be able to say that, so you thought I knew what it meant. There was a flaw, an error that meant that there was a certain probability the result would be an error. The chance Intel calculated was something like 1 out of 360 billion. They estimated that if you ran a spreadsheet for 27,000 years, you might hit it once. A flaw, an error, a mistake at the core of the operating system of this chip. Now, of course, America was not going to stand by quietly in the face of this flaw. No, America launched a revolution in response. Here they are, marching in the streets all across America. This is China. Okay, not actually, but there really was an extraordinary outrage at this flaw, and people rose up and they demanded, fix the flaw, Intel, and Intel, in the first year, had to spend close to $500 million answering the demand to fix the flaw, and millions turned their machines in to have the flaw fixed. Now, here's the code for that little bit of the Pentium chip where the flaw actually, it turns out I left the code to the Pentium chip at home, so I had to make up some code here. So some made-up code at the core of the Pentium chip where the flaw was. And I want you to look at this code and see the deep connection between this code at the operating system of this central machine of the PC world and this code at the operating system of a central machine of democracy.
The image dissolves from computer code to the U.S. Constitution.
And I want you to ask the question, what happens when there are flaws, errors, mistakes in that code? What happens when that code misfires? What do? How do we respond? Because if we're going to have a revolution to protect the spreadsheet, what do to defend democracy? Now, people look at this question and they say, well, you know, this is really different. You know, the issues in a spreadsheet, they're right or wrong. But government questions, they're not right or wrong. There are lots of hard, conflicting issues. And that's right. Not all questions, though, the government faces turn out to be hard questions. There are easy cases that government faces. There are 2 + 2 = 4 questions that government faces. And the question is, how does our operating system handle these questions? Now, for 10 years, I spent my life fighting one set of these 2 + 2 = 4 questions. That battle began around October 27, 1998, when Congress passed a statute named in honor of this man, a statute called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. A statute which extended the term of existing and future copyrights by 20 years. The 11th time Congress had extended the term of existing copyrights in the last 40 years, just every time Mickey was about to enter into the public domain, the Mickey Mouse Protection Act was enacted. Now, I looked at this statute, and then I looked at the document that I usually use when I teach this course called Constitutional Law, and I found in this document this text. Actually, I had the original version. It was like that. The text says, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing 4 limited times. And I thought, that's puzzling. How can Congress extend the term of an existing copyright when the Constitution says they can grant these copyrights only for limited times? And more puzzling, how could it promote progress to extend the term of a copyright for a work that already exists? So I looked at these 2 puzzling problems, and I did what every good liberal law professor does. I filed a lawsuit about the question. And we raced to the Supreme Court. There I am in the Supreme Court arguing this question that the framers would never have allowed this type of law, arguing to a bunch of conservative justices who happened to be asleep that day, because this was a total bust. We lost 7-2 in that case. The court upheld Congress's power to extend the term of copyrights as many times as big media buys the right to extend the term of existing copyrights. Now, in that defeat, though, there was an extraordinary unanimity about a fundamental policy question. Did this act of extending the term of existing copyrights advance the public good at all? We had a brief filed by 17 economists, including 5 Nobel Prize winners, including James Buchanan, Ronald Close, and Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman said he would sign the brief only if the word no-brainer existed in the brief someplace. No-brainer, Milton Friedman said. Apparently there were no brains here when they passed that statute. But after a decade of this work, I had that kind of flash of genius insight. You know, the sort of thing that convinces me that I must be a bright person who deserves a professorship at Stanford. Kind of flash of genius. The flash was this. It's not just here that government screws up in fundamental ways. Here's some others, right? For example, nutrition. There's a consensus that we eat too much of this stuff, not enough of this stuff. 2003, the World Health Organization tried to help with this problem. They set a standard of 10% being the total amount of calories that you get from something called sugar. Well, the sugar industry, though they have this little sweet image here, they went ballistic. There they are, ballistic about this claim. They got the United States Senate to threaten to withdraw funding from the WHO if they didn't withdraw their recommendation that no more than 10% of our calories should come from sugar. Here's the letter from the Senate, signed by Larry Craig, demanding that they back down from this outrageous position and adopt what was the reasonable position, according to the sugar industry, that 25% of your calories come from sugar. Well, the WHO wouldn't back down, but our government did. In 2003, the Food Nutrition Board issued standards saying 25% of your calories should come from sugar. So here is a balanced diet, according to our government. You can start with some Fruit Loops or M&M in breakfast. With a glass of milk, you can then have a cheeseburger, pizza for dinner, actually three slices of pepperoni pizza, and cookies, sugar cookies. That's a balanced diet, according to our government. Here was another easy public policy question our government gets wrong. Or maybe most profound, global warming. Right, we've all come to recognize the extraordinary danger global warming presents, but there has long been a consensus about this danger. The consensus that we're doing it, as Al Gore describes it, the debate is over. There are 5 points in this consensus. Number one, global warming is real. Number two, we human beings are mainly responsible. Number three, the consequences are very bad. Number four, we need to fix it quickly. And number five, it's not too late. Now, they did a study to evaluate how well that consensus was actually adopted by people who know something about the matter. So they took a random sample of 1,000 articles in peer-reviewed journals between 1993 and 2003. And they discovered that 0%, exactly zero, questioned the basic assumptions. Then they did a comparable study of articles in popular media journals between 1988 and 2002, 600 articles. They found that 53% questioned the basic consensus. Now, that result is a product of the junk science that's been funded by the oil industry to make people think that 2 and 2 might be 5 under some circumstances. Who knows? We can't really tell. Leading to the extraordinary delay that our government has allowed, maybe 10 years before we address perhaps the most important public policy question our generations will face. Again, an easy question. Government just gets wrong. And in all these easy cases, which the government gets wrong, not just esoteric questions about whether Mickey Mouse will be free, but core questions, the most important questions, 2 + 2 = 4 questions, the government gets wrong. And so when that happens, what happens then? What about these mistakes, these errors, these flaws in the operating system of our government? What do we do about these? Now, the framers of our Constitution were obsessed with the idea of independence, by which I don't mean the independence of 1776. I mean the independence that was at the center of their attention in 1785, the moment when every sane thinker recognized America was a failure, when they recognized that the extraordinary corruption that had spread through state governments that could not be checked by a federal government was destroying democracy. And they looked for independence in representatives. They looked to the lack of independence in representatives as the cause of this extraordinary corruption. They looked at the dependence of representatives. They were dependent upon interests other than the people or the public interest, as Jefferson described dependency. It begets subservience and venality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition. They saw this is what government had become, and they sought non-dependent, independent representatives who could find the right answer for the right reason to questions government faced. And it was their common aim to build institutions, to build constitutions against that dependence. Now, it's not very PC to say, but let's say it. They failed. They failed. Many who went to government through the history of our government were drawn to government for the most venal of reasons. Corruption was at the center of government throughout the country for most of our history, much worse than anything we've ever seen. Daniel Webster, at the time when he served in Congress, at the time Congress was considering whether to establish or how to regulate the Bank of the United States, was paid by the Bank of the United States. Here's a letter he wrote to the bank. If it be wished that my relation to the bank be continued, it may be well to send me the usual retainers. Bribery was not even a crime in Congress until 1853. The 19th century was a cesspool of corruption, and not just among politicians. In many jurisdictions around the country, up to 25% of voters sold their vote. Simple transaction. Buy it, it was sold, and voting was in public, so you could check who did what. So there's no golden past here. Our past is awful in lots of different ways, and we're better today. We're much better today in all of these ways. We have a Congress filled with people who come to Congress with a single idea for about 10 seconds. But that's the idea they come to Congress with. The idea is, I'm going to do good. I'm going to take my values, whether you agree with them or not, but I take my values and I do good with them. But here's the paradox. Even though from the individual perspective, we're much better today than we've ever been in the past, this problem is much worse for the nation. And that's because government is more significant today than it has ever been in the history of our nation. It's more critical to core national problems like healthcare and global warming, but it's more pervasive. Its fingers are everywhere. And increasingly, businesses realize the government is a tool of competition. The return from good regulation turns out to be higher than the return from good competition. And so that there's an explosion, there it is, in the influence game. The number of lobbyists in Washington has doubled since 2000. The cost of them has doubled as well. As the former lobbyist, chief lobbyist for President Clinton put it, people in industry are willing to invest money because they see opportunities here. And the public sees them too. Public skepticism about Congress has never been higher, and the respect for Congress has never been lower. When I toyed for about 10 seconds with the idea of running for Congress in an open seat in my district, we did some polling that discovered 88% of voters in the California district I live in believe that money buys results. And nationally, 19%, only 19%, worse than President Bush, have a favorable view of our Congress. The People's House is not. Now, the thing I want you to recognize about these facts that you all recognize and know and think about all the time is that this is exactly the dependency that our framers were worried about. Indeed, it is much worse than the dependency they thought they'd have to worry about. This is not the dependency Madison worried about. Madison spoke often as Ronald Reagan actually spoke. Here's Reagan talking about democracy in 1965, as he quoted someone else. "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government," Reagan said. "It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy." Collapses. But the thing Madison and Reagan missed is the problem we face is not a problem of the masses rising up and stealing money from the rich. That's not been a problem for as long as we can remember. The problem we face is exactly the opposite way around. It is the powerful using their power to capture government. And so long as there is private funding of public elections, that capture will continue. Crony capitalism. Crony capitalism is at the core of our Constitution today, a subtle form of corruption by good people. Deadly for democracy. Now, this conference is an extraordinary celebration. I don't think there's been a social movement that has grown as fast or as successfully as this movement has grown in the last 7 years. This is a movement growing to attack core substantive issues, the issues around media, that will have profound process consequences. But the question I want you to think about today is, when we succeed here, meaning succeed with media, will these problems go away, meaning the problems of dependence I've just been describing? Or maybe put differently, can we succeed here in the problems of media before these problems go away, the problems of dependence? Well, I took my Intel Pentium chip and I did the calculation, and it turns out the answer is no and no. Fixing media can't fix this dependency alone. Because a well-informed public still has a private life, meaning always there will be stuff happening below the radar. All the action falls below the radar, and it won't be caught by even the most well-informed public. And even worse, we can't fix this before we fix this, meaning we can't fix media before we fix the dependence, because of the way this dependence destroys the efforts that we pursue in fixing media. For example, think about spectrum regulation. Since about 2001, there was a pretty strong consensus among policymakers that we should be experimenting at least with much more unlicensed spectrum. That was because of an explosion in innovation in Wi-Fi and other such technologies taking advantage of unlicensed free spectrum, and we should have more of that innovation. Yet, policy here has moved in exactly the opposite direction. Since 2001, we had much more licensed spectrum, less unlicensed spectrum. And is this a surprise? And is it a surprise that the spectrum is deployed in a way to enable further concentration of the owners of spectrum, who will then leverage that concentration, if Tim Wu doesn't have his way, to control how we deploy the internet? Or second, you all should know this statute. This is the Communications Act, 1934. It has six titles. Title II covers something called telecom. Title VI covers cable. Traditionally, telecom was regulated by common carrier principles. Cable was not regulated by common carrier principles. At the birth of the internet, not that he was responsible for it, but at the birth of the internet, Al Gore had an idea about how to reorganize this title. He wanted to take Title II telecom and cable as it relates to the internet and put it under Title VII, and then deregulate Title VII. So minimal regulations require interconnect, but nothing much more than that. Gore's team took this to the Hill. The Hill's response was, hell no. How are we going to raise money from the telecoms if we deregulate them? Their question was. Now, there's a simple word for this dynamic. We should use it more often. It is extortion. Extortion. And the question we should ask our friends on the right is, how much extortion-enabling regulation is there out there? If you're worried about regulation, maybe you should begin to wonder why there is so much, and this dynamic might explain it. And how much less would there be if we had public funding of public elections? Now, my point in talking about this here is not to get you to give up the work of media reform. It's to ask you instead to recognize we need to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time. Either reform will depend upon both succeeding. And we need a good way to figure out how to address and make understandable these ideas of corruption and dependency and betrayal. And we need to make them clear if we're going to fix both of them. Now, this was the idea that Joe Trippi and I were noodling about when we were trying to figure out how we could take this wonderfully generative rhetoric of change and change it into something that would really make it a change. And that's why we launched this thing called Change Congress, which is a bipartisan reform movement designed to leverage reform work of others. The many others who have been working in this field substantively for generations. Think of it as a kind of Google mashup of these different reform movements, taking a cluster of issues, money, representation issues, integrity, and using the extraordinary new tools or the GNU tools that could drive reform in this space. We have a window, 8 years, where we understand these tools better than they do. And we can deploy them in a way to make change happen before they figure out what's happening. Now, we launched this project modeled on another CC project I've worked on, Creative Commons, which asked people to voluntarily pledge, people with the power here to voluntarily pledge, a commitment to these basic ideas of reform, both citizens and candidates. And the core first pledges we've been talking about are, number one, that you will not accept money from lobbyists or PACs. Number two, a fundamental reform of earmarks. Number three, supporting public financing of public elections. And four, supporting an increase in transparency in how Congress functions. But I come here to talk you. You've been fighting the most important issue for getting democracy to work again. I want you to help fight the other most important issue for getting democracy to work again. We need your talent and passion and commitment and idealism, and most importantly, we need your success here. We all need it here. So you can go there and help us, join us, to change this Congress, as you help all of us to change the media that will define that Congress. Now, let me just end with one more thought. The flaw at the core of the People's House is dependency. You all understand this problem of dependency. You know it's dynamic. Think of it in your life. There isn't one of you whose lives have not been touched in some dramatic and horrible way by the dependency of an alcoholic. I know my life has. And when you think of the dynamic of the dependency of an alcoholic, the alcoholic might be losing his family, his job, his liver, but we all know he will not solve any of those problems unless he solves his alcoholism first. So it's not that the alcoholism is the most important problem. It's just the first problem he needs to solve if he's to solve the rest.